Yeah, there's a lot of re-tippers out there, and it frustrates me no end because people are they're buying the cantilevers from Japan, and they're getting people's cartridges, cutting and shunting them, putting brass splints in, and doing some horrendous things that you wouldn't believe. Right. When I re-tip a cartridge, I'm making the cartridge back like it was new again.
Andrew here, Not an Audiophile, episode 10. We've just come back, when I say we, Brad, myself, Sharon, just come back from the Melbourne Stereo Net Hi-Fi and AV show, which I'd have to say was a great success for everybody concerned. Everyone seemed happy and fantastic exhibitors, lots of great displays, lots of happy hi-fi enthusiasts wandering around and audiovisual enthusiasts wandering around enjoying great sounds. Lots of Australian manufacturers there, which was a pleasure. Many. I'm not going to mention them all at this stage. We're going to cover that in a future episode. What we did do, or Brad did on his in his roving reporting, was catch up with two future guests on the show. Chris Allman, who's more or less a cartridge maker. And I'm not sure that anyone realised we made cartridges in Australia, but apparently we do. I didn't know, but I've found out. Chris is a great guy. I had a chat with him myself as well. Does the incredibly fine work of re-tipping cartridges. And, of course, Brad also caught up with Kim Ryrie, somewhat of a legend in Australian electronic and audio design, known, of course, many years ago for the Fairlight synthesizer, his involvement with that. He wasn't the only person involved, but certainly one of the geniuses behind that. A very, very smart man. And, of course, he has his DEQX, or DEX as it is generally known, DSP, preamplifier, DAC, streaming apparently now type product that you can use to turn a box full of random drivers into an amazing sounding high-end loudspeaker. At least I think that's the gist of it. So, Chris is up first. And now these are roving reports. The audio is good for show conditions, quite intelligible. But of course, when we have them on the show, one would like to think the audio would be slightly better. And we'll also, in the case of Kim, nail him down on sort of structure of the range of his products and what they can achieve. So thanks for listening and enjoy.
Okay, Matt Staff, and welcome back to the MCG. It's Richie Benno here to introduce you to John DeCenzi and
Chris Allman of All Clear Audio.
Yeah, anyway, enough of my silliness. John, how do you know Chris? What's the connection?
Connection is via a turntable that a few of us are kind of building, and I think that's how it came about, didn't it?
Yeah, there's through Kevin and
Warren Jones.
Yeah, Warren Jones.
Okay,
he's,
right.
He's building a super duper sort of reference turntable.
Okay, and there's a few of you sort of joining the team to. Are you part of the Sonic Hoops to listen?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we are. Right. We are. So Chris retips and manufactures his own line of incredible cartridges.
Oh, geez, right.
He's
okay.
One of the best re-tippers in Australia, if not the world.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. And what did I see in your room there? What were you showing me?
This is a bit of my baby. I've always been interested in passive preamps. Back when I was 15 or 16, when I was messing around with DIY audio, I used to make the most basic of a passive pot, which is literally a pot and a plastic box and ins and some outs. And of course, the problem with that is your source is seeing a different load as you're turning the pot up, so it messes with the frequency. And it sort of interested me for a bit as a kid, but and then as the years go by, you see there's other ways of doing this. You can have a resistive pot, and again, that's got its own set of problems.
Yeah.
And then there's the transformer based pots, but the issue with these is the iron core, and the iron core of the transformer causes a dip and a peak in the curve. And I heard about somebody winding these amazing Transformers, and I got him to do some for me, which have got this permanalloy core.
Yeah.
And yeah, the specs are just out of this world. Flat to 35,000 hertz.
Wow.
A beautiful, square wave. So I made one with the most basic box and a stepped pot.
Yeah.
And it was out of this world. So I spoke to John and said, how can we make this really audiophile? How can we make this happen? And he sort of helped me on the way to making the beautiful thing you saw in there.
It's stunning. It's gorgeous.
It is.
I know Andrew Hutchinson will love the look of that. So you two combined to do the design on the final?
Pretty much.
Okay, brilliant.
Yeah. So there was a lengthy software kind of development. We wanted to make it remote control, have balance control. We also has a special feature for a passive preamp, which is actually having gain. So it's got a 6 dB gain switch, which is very useful for a passive. And have I missed anything else out?
No, there's a mute as well.
There's
really nothing out there. Everything else on the passive front, apart from nobody's got 6 dB again, is they've got a motorized pot generally.
Yes.
So you've got a big motorized pot and then a rat's nest of wires going to the back of the motorized pot. So you open it up and look inside and it's horrible. And because it's a motorized pot, there really is no way of giving you balance. And I said from the outset, we need balance. So what we've done is, with John's help, is we've got really high quality relays and we can switch out one channel and not the other. So we've got balance all on the remote, and you haven't got all these horrible wires everywhere.
Which might introduce noise, I assume. What's the, pardon my ignorance.
They can act as antennas and pick up all sorts of noise, but also you're lengthening the signal path, which actually always reduces the signal integrity, or can compromise it if it's not done properly. So, and when you've got so many secondary wires as a step attenuated transformer, it's very hard to kind of twist them all together to kind of reduce crosstalk and interference. So we've eliminated all that by having a very sort of multi-layer printed circuit board that actually takes care of all the messy wiring, so you get this beautiful, neat product.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Right, now the gain, how that works is that no other passive has got gain. So how basically a transformer-based attenuator works is you've got so many turns, a certain number of turns on the primary, and then you've got stepped increasing turns on the secondary until it's one-to-one.
Yeah.
What we can do is we can switch out a section of the primary. So you've got, it's not 10 turns, it's hundreds, but if you had 10 turns here and 10 turns on the out, that's one-to-one. If you've got 5 turns here and 10 turns here, you double the volume.
Yeah.
So we looked at what point changing what the source sees becomes an issue and starts to change things. And it's way above what we've actually done. So 6 dB doesn't hurt anything, and you've got gain.
Excellent, right, yeah. Crossing that threshold.
Crossing that threshold. But just if you want to keep it all pure, we've got it on a switch on the remote, 6 dB on, 6 dB off.
Brilliant. What is it going to sell for? Are you selling it direct or via retail?
We're looking at retail, and at this point it's looking around $17,000, but we've got a show special of $10,000, which is actually quite cheap when you consider the amount of technology in this thing.
And
the transformers are very special.
Obviously, that's the reason why getting these transformers made a difference, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely.
To the whole course.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And have you got retailers lined up?
I've got some distributors who are interested, and we've met a few people at the show, so probably after the show we'll have more of who that might be. Yeah.
Excellent.
Well, the other thing I do is I'm a cartridge retipper. I also build cartridges, and I'm a little
bit... Is
that
right? Wow.
Yeah, I've got a couple coming out. If this show was another 2 weeks away, we would have had a cartridge here, but it was just... The engine was made, but the bodies weren't quite ready, and we just ran out of time. But, very, very, very proud of what we...
Very exciting.
Very exciting, yeah.
And all made here.
All made here. I wind the coils myself, solder the coils myself. Everything is done myself.
Amazing. And one thing I haven't mentioned, the brand.
All Clear Audio.
wasn't clear to me before because I forgot to ask and state it.
So yeah, yeah, no, all clear, Audio.
All clear, yeah. Well, brilliant, Chris. I'll come back to you and we'll chat some more, Kevin. You're an attractive man.
No worries. Yep.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah, there's a lot of retippers out there, and it frustrates me no end because people are, they're buying the cantilevers from Japan, and they're getting people's cartridges, cutting and shunting them, putting brass splints in, and doing some horrendous things that you wouldn't believe.
Right.
When I retip a cartridge, I'm making the cartridge back like it was new again. I've been doing some for Nirvana, Koetsu's, many thousand dollars, and I'll be removing the front pole piece, cleaning the coils, rotating the suspension to fresh suspension, removing any broken bits out of the stub, new cantilever in, and when it all goes back together again, they've effectively got a new Koetsu or yeah. Whatever
so
it might
restoration's be. Restoration's probably not a good enough term.
It's not a retip. It's a complete service and. It's as new, and I'm aligning the tips to within a degree. If I do a diamond only, it can take me several hours to make sure that diamond is absolutely spot on, which you actually don't often get on a factory cartridge because they haven't got the time that I've got to sit there for 2.5 hours making it absolutely perfect.
This is what I suppose in the old days of racing cars, blueprinted. If you like, everything is sort of the tolerances are. Your intolerances are really tight.
They're really tight, and I've also gone to the extent of Koetsu's now finished and gone, and I've managed to find out, because it was never published, I found out which diamonds they were using, and I've actually got them to make me a whole, which a lot of money, but I've got them to make me a run of diamonds, so into the future I'll be able to, December they'll arrive, I'll be able to retip a Koetsu. It would be indistinguishable from factory.
Dare I use the term gobsmacking? That's brilliant, mate.
Oh well, yeah, it's a passion. It's if I'm not retipping, I'm doing something similar related for myself. So it's more than a business.
It comes from the heart, and I get that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thanks, mate.
No worries at all. Happy to speak. Yeah, how it sort of all really started to happen for me was I did a retip for Mark, who's running the Stereonet show here, and Mark Doman. Fitted that cartridge to his turntable,
right.
And Mark Doman sort of went, this is nice, and then Mark Doman contacted me from that contact and sent me a box of cartridges, and I opened the box of cartridges and I thought, oh yeah, I can do that one, I can do that one, and then the next one, this is destroyed, the suspension was split, the coils were broken, it was just an absolute mess, so the cartridge was worth maybe $1,000, and there's not $1,000. It's not worth doing. So I rang up Mark and said, yeah, look, Mark, this I can do those two, but this one's not worth doing. And he said, oh, it's got sentimental value. Could you do it for me anyway? And at the time I thought, why does he want to do this? This is nuts. Look, okay, Mark, whatever, And I rewound the cartridge and I put a new cantilever diamond on and suspension and made it as new. And I sent it back to Mark, and he rang me up, and he said, you've just built a cartridge. And I said, yes, I know. And he said, you'll also be doing all the work for Nirvana.
Wow,
so,
brilliant.
Yeah, so
you almost, was it a test, dare I ask?
It was a test, yes.
He's a smart bugger, isn't he?
He is.
And you more than passed muster. I jumped, well, in terms of high jump, you cleared it by a fair way. Brilliant. That's
no.
So that got you on the move as far as your own coverage.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That's a great story.
So, thanks, Chris, for the info there related to retipping, et cetera, and how you sort of almost accidentally ended up manufacturing a cartridge from scratch. And now on to Kim. So Kim Ryrie, as mentioned in the introduction, somewhat of a legend. The guy is a genius. This interview with Brad has cornered him in the back of his room during the show. And I guess it's a somewhat of a stream of consciousness without a laying out of the finer details of what the range of the products are. So enjoy, but if you have questions, which you may do, we will absolutely get them answered in a future episode when he's interviewed between now and Christmas. And of course, comment, send us an email. Details are on the website. Or of course comments on the YouTube video, well not video, it's an audio, an audio with a picture. But at least you can comment there, so feel free to ask questions. We'll have him answer them when he's on the show. So here you go now. Here's Kim with talking about his new Gen 4 range of products.
So, Kim, we were talking earlier about one of your new products regarding taking old speakers. Is that what you were saying? Prompt me, mate, if you will.
Yeah, so with the new decks, what we call Generation 4, because we're now 27-year-old sort of startup. So we've sort of been doing R&D for like 27 years. And yeah, we've had these products that have been very difficult to work because, you know, there were 160-page operating manuals and it was all Windows-based software that needed a lot of hand-holding. And, but what it was effectively was we introduced the idea of using impulse response correction for drivers in loudspeakers, so woofer, mid-range, because they all have, as we know, they've all got frequency response errors, but the stuff that is virtually impossible to address in the analog world is the timing and phase response.
Yeah.
And usually a lot of the sort of equalization you used to do in the analog domain could actually cause more phase problems than you're starting with. So what we call sort of group delay errors, where some frequency groups are sort of more delayed than others. And it's only in the order of milliseconds or fraction of a millisecond, but sound travels 1 foot in a millisecond, you know, 30 centimetres in a millisecond, so it's not insignificant.
Mm, yeah.
And it happens a lot because of the electromechanics of loudspeakers, which is why loudspeakers are essentially the showstopper when it comes to affordable reproduction of true high-definition audio.
Yeah.
And it's why, you know, the best of them can cost $100,000 a pair, you know, when they get it right.
The buck stops with the loudspeaker, in a sense.
The buck stops with the loudspeaker.
Yeah.
And then you've got the added problem that you're trying to get an amplifier that will do 10 octaves of audio along one speaker cable. You know, it's all hard work. So then you're not only paying a lot of money for the speakers, but you're then paying a lot of money for really good amplifiers that can pump, you know, tens of amps for bass frequencies and you know, and yet still have air happening in the tweeters. It's not easy.
No.
You know?
No.
So better in, you know, in the pro world went active decades ago.
Yeah.
Whereby you've got a separate amplifier for every type of driver, so typically one for bass, one for mids, one for tweeter.
Yeah.
That means you're dividing the audio into sort of three or four octaves per driver. That makes the job much easier for the amplifiers. It makes it much easier for the cables. It makes it basically much easier for everything. And I experienced that when our band back in the 70s got hold of a pair of Altec Voice of the Theatre speakers, which is the big sort of you know, horn reflex bass thing with a horn on top, and it had an Altec passive crossover, and we used to blow the drivers up
regularly,
you know, every month or two at least we'd blow the diaphragm up in the tweeter. And someone said, well, why don't you do this actively, you know? And at the time I helped start a magazine called Electronics Today. Became ETI, Electronics Today International.
Yeah, remember it well.
And we used to do projects every month, and one of those was a little 100-watt amplifier module. And so I got a couple of those, and then I made a 24 dB per octave active filter at the front end. So this was my first experience of doing an active speaker. And you know, so we had one amp on the horn and the other for the woofer, and put them all in the box, and we never blew up another horn again. But more to the point, everything just got so much cleaner. And, I'm thinking, well, hang on, this is really pretty easy to do. You know, why isn't everything active?
Yeah.
And, of course, in the pro audio world, it was already. Active, but Active didn't suit the marketing of consumer audio because you needed a box that you only needed two wires to connect to the box.
Yep.
You needed one amp for one speaker. That everyone could deal with that.
Keep it simple.
Yeah. Keep it simple. Kiss. And admittedly, you know, it would have been very difficult to do it any other way. And back in the day, you know, amplifiers were expensive. You just couldn't sort of come up with lots of amplifiers for no money.
Yeah.
So, but what we did when we started Dex, and that's another story, you know, I'd been doing, my company was Fairlight, where we used the first DSP, we used the first Motorola DSP chips at Fairlight to do the computer musical instrument. After I'd left Fairlight, a programmer, no, I was still working actually at Fairlight, but one of the guys had started a company called Lake, and he rang me up and said, oh, look, we've developed this headphone technology using finite impulse response filters, which I knew very little about at the time.
Right.
And he said, so come and have a listen. And so he showed me these this processing that we could do with it, or that they were doing with a chip that the CSIRO had developed. It was called the A250 or something like that. And it did 250 what's called taps of finite impulse response filtering. And he had a little 6-inch car loudspeaker in a shoebox.
Absolutely brilliant.
And he'd measured this speaker, and they'd created this impulse response filter that corrected it. And they thought they'd make their fortune selling these chips to car audio, to car manufacturers, to make speakers sound better. And sure enough, it did. It was a very short, in today's terms, it was a very short, low-resolution correction because of the technology at the time. But it made a difference to the speaker. And
excuse me.
And he said, you know, could Fairlight use this? And I said, well, Fairlight don't make speakers, so, you know, we can't really do that. And but, you know, maybe we could think of doing speakers because this is really cute, this technology. And then just as I was leaving, he said, oh, by the way, it takes about 250 milliseconds of processing, so that adds like quarter of a second of latency. And I said, no, sorry, we just could never use that. But let me know. But he said, but we think we've got a solution to that. And I said, well, great, let me know.
This is Lake.
This is now Lake. They left the CSIRO. They'd started Lake. And a year later, I got a phone call. Well, we fixed the latency. come and have a listen. So I had another listen, and they said, could you help us? We're doing headphones out of headphone technology where the sound that you're listening through headphones seems to be coming outside of your head. And it was really impressive. And they said, well, could you help us market this? And at the time, I was not really full-time at Fairlight. I was more a consultant. And I said, yeah, I've got time to do that. And so we ended up, long story short, we ended up selling Lake to Dolby.
Excuse me one second, Kim. Remnants of the cold, sorry about this. So you sold Lake to Dolby?
Well, we ended up turning people on. Lake went public. Dolby discovered the headphone technology. And I said, well, why don't you use this to do loudspeakers? And Brian said, who was the CEO? He said, no, why don't you do it?
Because lobbed it your way.
We're too busy doing the headphone stuff, you know, why don't you do it? You know, we found it's all pretty difficult, but, you know, and you should use this guy, Paul Glendenning, who was one of our engineers, and he's a genius. And so Paul and I started, at the time we called it Clarity EQ, and we were going to license their patent to do the low latency FIR. But when Dolby bought them, they said, oh, sorry, you can't, we're not going to license our patent. So we'd already started Clarity, and Paul said, don't worry, I know another way to do this. So we did it another way. We got a patent for the way we did it. The only difference was we had to use floating point DSP instead of fixed point, which made it a little bit more expensive at the day. It doesn't make any difference these days.
So you circumvented their
block. So, and then that's how effectively Clarity started. And so basically what it meant was that you could, as I was saying, you know, the loudspeaker electromechanics have a lot of problems, especially the cheap ones. So you could measure their frequency response errors, their timing, their group delay errors, and you could create a filter, and in using the finite impulse response filters, you could compensate the audio that's driving each transducer to compensate for all those problems.
The shortcomings, yeah.
And for instance, you would fix, you know, you obviously can't speed up delayed frequencies, but you could slow down the frequencies that were on time.
Yeah.
And let the slower ones catch up, and then you glue it all back together again. And so that's what
group delay ends up being.
So group delay ends up, and we only had to add, you know, say 5 milliseconds of delay to pull that off. So so that's always been the fundamental stuff. And at the same time, we correct the frequency response or set it to a target. So that was the fundamental stuff that we formed the company to do.
That's the basis of Clarity, then DEX.
That's right. And the problem was that we could only use DSP chips at the time. This is now back in the late 90s.
Right.
So we came up with a way of using two DSPs, two Shark DSPs, which were the best around at the time.
Yeah.
And we managed to fit... to do quite long filters. I think we ended up doing, just trying to think, would have been at 16, about 20,000 taps.
Right.
Okay, but that was across stereo, so it's only about 10,000 taps per left and right channel, and we go, say, 2,000 taps to the tweeter and 4,000 to the mid-range, another 4,000 to bass, which wasn't...
So when you say taps, just for...
Taps, so... Taps means the resolution by which you can...
Grabs?
Sort of grabs, yes. Effectively, it's grabs, but if you want to work it out mathematically, let's say you're doing a sample rate of, I won't say 44.1K to keep the number simple, let's say 40K sample rate. And let's say you've got a 4K tap filter. Well, you divide that 4K by 40K, and you've got 10K.
Yeah.
So, sorry, 10 hertz, I should say.
Yeah.
So that was the resolution we had.
Gotcha. Okay.
Okay. Now, here's where it all gets weird. People said, oh, you're not only doing stuff at 44.1, we want to do everything at 96K. So, okay, now you can divide 4K by 96K, and you don't have 10 hertz resolution anymore. Now your resolution's gone to 20 hertz, actually about 24 hertz, right? Which is a whole octave.
Yeah.
More. So you've got virtually no resolution down in the bottom octave.
Right.
So when people say, oh, you know, you'll get more resolution going to 96K, well, it's the exact opposite. You've actually halved your resolution that you could correct the timing information. So, so fortunately these days, everyone's worked out that the high sample rates are a complete and utter waste of time. You know, especially to all us baby boomers who can't hear a thing over 10K anyway. So,
I couldn't possibly admit that, Kim. I can't. So, I can't. Yeah, we go. Yeah, you're
so
right.
So we spent a lot of time making everything run at 96K to sort of meet with all the marketing
expectations. Yeah.
So now, and of course, we can do processing at whatever you like. We can do 192K, whatever. So every time you double the sample rate, you halve the resolution of your correction within the frequencies you can actually hear.
Yes. Yeah. Especially in the bass end.
Yeah, but now that everything is being streamed on Tidal and Cubase and whatever at typically, you know, 48K, 24 bits, that's right down our alley, because that means we're running at what I call an ideal sample rate.
Yes.
Gives us good resolution. We're now running much longer filters in the new generation products.
Right, so
we can do...
really good.
Yeah, so we're getting much more resolution, getting more like, for instance, in the... in the bottom octave in 20 to 40 hertz octave. We get about quarter octave at the moment, and we can do better than that if we want to. It's sort of good enough.
Yeah.
And as you go up in octaves, you're getting more and more resolution.
Yeah, as you go. Yeah.
So yeah. So that's so the resolution is like four to eight times better in the new system than the old system. And we've got more channels. We've got eight, so we can do four-way crossovers. The other issue I discovered is that, and you know, of course, the steeper the crossovers you use,
yes,
the more you can make each driver work in their comfort zone.
Yeah.
So if you've only got a very shallow crossover, say between the bass, the woofer, and the mid-range driver, for example, if you only had a 12 dB per octave, you know, two-pole filter,
yeah,
then an octave below that crossover frequency, and let's say the crossover frequency is 200 hertz, that means that mid-range driver is still getting quite a lot of bass energy,
yeah,
hitting it, which is causing it to move towards its X-max,
yes,
which, yep, is upsetting it.
Yeah, inner modulation, distortion, and all,
yeah,
that sort of stuff.
And it's just introducing stuff that's not supposed to be there. So if we introduce a, as Alan was saying, we tend to use something like, well, from bass to mid-range, we use 72 dB per octave.
Right.
So that's a 12-pole filter. That's,
yeah,
all verging on a brick wall filter.
Yeah.
That means that you can sort of go as loud as you like, and the mid-range driver is going to be as happy as Larry,
yeah,
because it's just not getting...
That excursion.
Excursion.
Yeah.
And it has the other advantage that also what happens is that the woofer, when it's allowed to be outputting audio above, let's call it a 200 hertz crossover to the mid-range,
yeah,
something in that order, it's starting to beam.
Yes.
If it's outputting frequencies not at 200 but at 400 and 800,
yep,
those frequencies are beaming forward, which, yep, is making the dispersion from the driver less natural.
Yeah.
And,
yep,
and the same applies when you're going from the mid-range to the tweeter, especially.
Yeah.
So these are all the advantages of steeper thing. Now, of course, you can't make filters that steep in the analog world. I mean, you can do it, but the phase corruption will be just out of control.
Yeah, yeah.
And the tolerance you would need on the components is equally out of control. So, but you can do it digitally, no problem. And because we're doing... because we're working in the time domain, we can actually make the crossovers stay in linear phase,
yes,
which normally you can't do in the analog world at all once you go past a 6 dB per octave, very, yeah, shallow filter.
Yeah.
So we can keep them linear phase at very steep crossovers, so we have minimal, almost no crossover distortion between drivers. And you're keeping the drivers happy as Larry.
It's all about comfort zone.
And it's all about even dispersion.
Yeah.
You can turn a lot of our drivers literally 180 degrees and they're verging on omnidirectional.
That's
that was our little party trick we used to do, yeah, with the NHT,
yeah,
speakers.
Oh, yes, way back. And, I remember
way
that.
Way back,
yeah,
when. And so...
Yeah, that's the goal, isn't the power response being... You know, as the power response in the room is even all the way around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which just tends to sound more natural, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you just get a wider sound stage.
And that's because, just for those who are listening, you're not getting that beaming, as you call it, the directivity of the driver drooping off axis.
Yeah.
So from the bass or the mid range or whatever, you're crossing over that optimum point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where it doesn't beam. Yeah.
Yeah. But then we're sort of trying, and I'm just sort of assuming the whole audio world's going to go active, you know, tomorrow afternoon. And just, it was just so naive that it was ridiculous, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, funnily enough, it's happening more now as people are getting into wireless speakers, because,
yes,
they have to put amplifiers in the speakers anyway, so they might as well put more of them.
Yeah.
And these days you can make amplifiers for $10, you know.
And very small.
In cheap,
yeah,
cheap speakers. So what we have been you know, to it wasn't a good business.
So in other words, you had a particular aim in mind, and it seemed like a bad idea
at the time.
Exactly. But it's morphed. It's mutated.
Yes, so that's right. So I, from day one, like 20 years ago, I'm just thinking we should just focus on active. We should try to get people to go active. And a lot of people did, of course, and we had we had OEMs doing it. But also because I was saying that the hardware was limited in its resolution, our resources were limited in terms of the amount of R&D we could do. We ran out of DSP memory, you know, a decade ago. All those sort of issues. So then, of course, the ARM processors came out, the sort of things that we have in our iPhones.
Yeah.
And they, over the last decade, have just got so insanely powerful. 64-bit, you know, quad-core, you know, orders of multitude more powerful than the DSP chips.
Yeah.
So we just had to ditch the DSP chips, which were fine for doing traditional audio stuff like simple crossovers and simple EQs and stuff like that, but they really were not good at doing the FIR stuff. So you just needed much more processing power and much more memory. So that's why the new ARM processors has made this, what we call Generation 4 stuff is. It's all based around multi-core processing and Linux, which is the operating system, you know, running it, which also then lets us get into internet streaming and all the other good things you can
that you currently have on the
models. So all the new models initially have streaming capabilities. We're using Volumio. We've got an arrangement with them, so we can do Tidal, Cubase and stuff. And we'll add, you can do AirPlay, so you can be running stuff directly from your phone, Spotify or whatever, just by AirPlay.
Yeah.
But so we've sort of tried to package everything into a more integrated solution. And then we've moved all our software. All the old software was running on Windows. There was nearly a million lines of code developed over 20 years.
Jesus.
And it was just a nightmare. And we thought, okay, this has got to go. Everyone hates Windows and having to have PCs running this stuff. Let's move it all to the cloud. So we had to rewrite all that stuff, a lot of it. And so we had five programmers working on this stuff for years. And
so this is the culmination of all that work with the new
right. So this is what we call the gen for generation four. So it was lots of years doing the hardware as well. We talk about disasters, right? So the first round of our hardware development used the AKM DACs and A to Ds and sample rate converters, and then the AKM factory in Japan burnt down. They couldn't make the chips. So we spent a year and a half designing that hardware, had to ditch the whole thing.
Christ.
Then I decided, I don't want to buy these ARM processor chips from Chinese companies because they'll just stop production, you know, unannounced. So let's use these OEM-specific ones that Samsung had brought out. They'd started a company called Arctic, and they made these very cute, beautifully made, little, small ARM processor hardware modules.
Yeah.
So we started to use them, and we'd spent about a year developing on that, and then they shut down the company because they weren't getting enough business. And I'd only chosen them because I thought, it's Samsung, we can rely on being able to get them forever. So...
I mean, it's okay if you're an athlete and you're running in the hurdles. Generally, the hurdles stay the same as you get towards the finishing line. Your hurdle's getting higher and bloody higher. So what happened then?
So then I'm thinking, holy mackerel, I'm going to have to sell the doghouse. keep funding this.
Yeah, that's funny. So, the doghouse you got, kid.
Yeah. So anyway, then we found a really good supplier in China, actually, that brought out not only... A good quad processor at the time, but they had an upgrade path for the future, which would maintain a lot of compatibility. So we were designing all that. So it's just been a lot of, you know, lots of balls in the air that had to come together. Yeah. So it's why, you know, we've been talking about this new product for years and it just kept having problems like this thrown at it.
And now it's...
So we're finally now, we've got about 100 of the beta units. We're in our... So when we finalised the new hardware, we went through three revisions of hardware just to get it right for production.
Yeah. Yeah.
So once we got to that point, we announced the beta program that we have. So the software's still in beta.
Yeah.
So that meant that we contacted all our old DEX, you know, we've got a lot of DEX users around the world.
Yeah.
And we offered them to be part of our beta software testing program.
Right.
About 100 of them took that up straight away. So we've got 100 units
that are out on test and getting...
They've been out on test for probably 5 months now.
So when we... sorry to interrupt you, but when we did the... I'll drop us into it momentarily. So when we did the show together in April, Australian Hi-Fi show in April in Sydney, that was just before you released those. Have there been many changes since we used your DEX?
There haven't been a lot of hardware changes. There's been a lot of software changes.
Right.
Yeah, and we've brought on new people in the software team. We've got 5 people doing software now. And we've got a new software director, a guy that, funnily enough, I used to work with, you know, 30 years ago. We were competitors. At Fairlight, we made a big, you know, multi-channel, massive digital mixing console workstation we used to sell to Hollywood. And he had another company called... I forget what they were called, but he made a competing... digital console. We're both selling them to Hollywood and they're all around the world.
Bloody hell.
Funnily enough, the top of the line stuff for big, high end, and these were all $100,000 a hit type consoles.
Back in what, the 70s or 80s? 80s.
This would have been the 90s, actually.
90s, wow.
Yeah, late 80s, 90s.
Early 90s, yeah.
And so we had, well, Fairlight had most of Hollywood. We had Todd A.O. Glenn, Paramount Pictures, Sony Pictures, they were buying these things, $100,000 each, to do all their post-production for their movies. We won an Oscar, actually, for services to the
statue.
Not you
per se.
Not me, but actually, I'll tell you who does. Chris Alfred, who's our CTO now.
Right.
He got the Oscar. He's got it at home.
Right? Do you take turns?
I'm
Oscar?
I'm not allowed to touch it, I don't think.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
So anyway, but Chris is amazing.
Fascinating. That's an amazing achievement.
Yes. Yeah. So we've just been so lucky, probably because of the Fairlight legacy. I've just always been lucky to have great people working with us.
And you've worked with them over that time and built those relationships.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like that bit of teamwork. So,
yeah,
so
and,
you're
and
now
they're still with
him
us.
Again.
So a lot of us, and Joe, who you met, Jonah Wright.
Yeah.
As I said, he was making the other console. He's a fantastic programmer. He's done everything, you know.
So
he's our COO now. I'm starting to get old, you know.
Can't believe you're saying that, Kim.
He's 10 years behind me, mate.
God, I don't want to know because you still look young, Kim, don't worry. But yes, we are both edging closer. Yeah.
So anyway, no, Joe's been fantastic and he's, he's a real programmer, unlike me, right? So he's able to just pull everyone together and get...
So he coordinates all that. But who was the fellow that you were competing with in Hollywood? I took you away from that main...
That was Joe. He was making...
Oh, sorry. I've got to apologise. I'll remember.
And he sold dozens and dozens of those. And we sold them to not only Hollywood. We had, NHK in Japan had dozens of these... Fairlight consoles that were in fact they were really expensive in Japan. They were like a couple of $100,000.
So two Australians were basically,
carving
it up.
We had the post production market sewn up.
Amazing.
And the early part of it anyway.
Yeah, yeah, the early
And
days.
Then what happened subsequently with Fairlight is it got bought by Blackmagic. right. in Melbourne who were focused on video. And they had the DaVinci video editor software,
yeah.
but they wanted to integrate audio
with
their video. So yeah. they bought Fairlight. And today, if you go to Blackmagic or DaVinci, it's the Fairlight operating system that's running all their audio. They can run Fairlight can now do thousands of tracks for post production. It's the fastest growing audio post production thing around, as far as I know. Because you can download it for free, the entry level version, and then you can buy hardware options, consoles, moving faders, the whole spot.
It's a modular approach.
And it's all fully integrated to the...
Incredible.
It's fantastic. They've done a fantastic job with that. And long story short, I always just thought the missing link in audio was the domestic playback environment. And so that's where we focused DEX, which DEX, by the way, I changed the name years ago, mainly because of trademark issues with Clarity. And DEX stands for Digital Equalization and Crossover, which is sort of, we sort of think a formula for doing a high definition loudspeaker. It's got to be digital,
yeah.
it's got to have equalization, but that also means time domain equalization, yes. not just frequency response.
Yeah.
And the crossover's key to get right, the linear phase crossovers.
Yeah.
So that's where
stuff that
work
passive comes. Designers only wish.
right. Yeah. But you're one of the few people that I've seen who can make a passive crossover sound amazing. Those little speakers from
the Mu 2.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And the problem is we can't make them sound much better, which is extremely unusual. Usually we can take almost any speaker, measure them, do a correction on them, and they can sound really alarmingly better.
Right.
Your speakers sound slightly better, I must admit, but not that much better.
No,
with the calibration.
I'm blushing somewhat, but I appreciate you saying
that. That's
great.
True. No, they're really astonishing. Thank you. And it's why they've had so many awards, and I just think that's very well deserved. So anyway,
thank you. I suppose the thing is that I know we've probably got a little bit of time constraint on you because you should be upstairs.
That's right.
Was there keep it so easy to just meander. But what we might do is a part two.
Right.
Give you a rest because I think probably need to go upstairs. Not because I want to stop, but I don't want to dominate. You were sort of going to talk about taking old speakers or whatever with the new Generation 4. And what I might do is grab you later.
Sure.
And we'll say, okay, break it up. Although, that wouldn't just say, hey, this is...
part of the reason why we did the amplifiers now as well, because that was always one of the problems for people going active. Oh, suddenly I need thousands of amplifier channels.
Yes.
And I don't want them looking big and clunky and being too expensive. So we've also...
And that what I filmed upstairs is that particular unit. When we had a show, that unit was... Well, that was a different unit to what you've got upstairs, correct?
Sorry, which one?
Well, how you've got the DAX on board, the streaming on top of the stand.
Yeah.
That one is the one that would potentially sell for what was 20,000? Is that right?
That lists in America. We do everything in US dollars because that's where our main markets are. But so that in America is like 15,900 US.
Right. Gotcha.
And so for the beta people, it's virtually half. I mean, it's because for beta, reading between the lines, right? Once we go public with the products in the next year, once we're out of beta, we've got to sell through retailers.
Yes, right, so okay.
Hence the pricing of the MSRP that's close to 16,000. So meanwhile, for people that want to sign on to be beta users and use the beta software, it's still production hardware, but it won't be full release software until the new year.
Right.
So meanwhile, they get beta
software. They get an advantage.
They get an advantage of cost because they can buy them direct from us. They can tell us, oh, we don't like this, we'd like you to do add this feature. We do all that. And it's great. So we've already got 100 people doing that. We're just running another 100 units now, which will be for beta. Because we'll have another 3, maybe 4 months of beta where that's an option for people to get onto the beta
and
program.
And then you can then...
after that, we can't undersell the retailers. So
what we might do is pause it now, and because you had a talk about, I'm trying to remember how we started this, talk about taking old speakers and sort of applying let's call it the decks, you know, playing around with the filters to take an old pair of speakers. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, what we also didn't talk about is that you can use decks. We have 3 models. And the one we've been talking about is the flagship, which is the one that can do active.
Yes.
And that you can upgrade existing passive speakers to active with that, or you can just build a speaker from scratch, or we sell those to OEMs who are doing their own designs from scratch. But the 2 other models, one of them is called the Pre 4, so it's designed, you just add an amplifier or 2, so it's just for main passive full range speakers.
Right, yes.
Or for that matter, full range active speakers.
Yeah.
And then you can add 1 or 2 subwoofers with that. So it's got 4 outputs, that's the reason for that. And then there's the LS200, so that's really for where you just want to add speakers and keep it simple for minimum. It's actually a bit cheaper, a few compromises to the design. That's the fully integrated, just add speakers.
And away you go.
Model and away you go.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit cheaper than the others as well.
Okay, great.